Welcome back, class. Today we have an interesting discussion for you about the 2016 horror film Don't Breathe. We use a recently published article by Don Keatley entitled Lock Her Up, Angry Men and Captive Women in Post-Recession Horror, as a jumping-off point to explore what this movie and others have to say about our current cultural moment. Before we get there, though, we talk a bit about It, Chapter 2, particularly Bill Hader's character Richie, so watch out for creepy clowns and spoilers.
Welcome to the junior year episode 7 of the Horror Podcast. My name is Tyler, and I am the editor-in-chief of Signal Horizon and a teacher at a local high school here in Kansas City, Missouri. Signal Horizon is the go-to place for smart genre programming. And for all of our coverage, you should go and check out SignalHorizon.com. I'm joined tonight by our co-host and book editor of Signal Horizon, Mike. What's going on, Mike?
Hey, man, not a whole lot. Had a great weekend. I saw It. Chapter two. I cooked some homemade pizzas.
Yum.
Yeah, and I'm ready to deconstruct some horror on this here podcast. So let's do it.
Awesome. Yeah. Good. I'm glad it's not on somebody else's podcast. That would be weird.
No, nobody else will have me anymore. You know that. All right, man. What are you reading? What are you watching? What are you excited about this week?
Yes, absolutely. So I got an early review copy of Memory, The Origins of Alien, which is going to have its debut at Fantastic Fest, which Signal Horizon is covering next week. It is unfreaking believable. And if I had a way to describe it in like one sentence, it would be like an anatomy of a scene, because the bulk of the movie is about the chest burster scene. And it is interesting. It is fascinating to see how they did all of those special effects, but they go really in deep about Geiger, who is one of the big designers, and the author that he kind of cribbed to create that particular monster. The artist was called, or you know, the artist's name is Francis Bacon. So it was just like a deep dive into Francis Bacon's work, and he is a weird, weird dude. So
that
is awesome.
That's awesome, because usually when everyone wants to talk about the art of Alien, they go straight to Geiger. And I like that they go back to some influences to Geiger, which is super, super cool. And yeah, Francis Bacon's got some messed up stuff.
Yeah, but it's creepy. And it didn't try to do too much. You know how sometimes like a documentary about a film gives everything like 2 minutes. So it's difficult to get a really in-depth look at things. The director made a really conscious choice to spend a lot of time on this particular scene because it's so iconic. And I really appreciated the depth that they went into in exploring it. So yeah, when it comes out, please check out Memory, The Origins of Alien, because it's super great.
Love it.
I'd say the other things, I'm checking out Creepshow, because Creepshow is coming out very soon. I can't say anything about it because, we essentially agreed to not spoil too much stuff, but I will tell you it's awesome. So you got to check it out. It's on Shudder. We have neglected the last couple weeks to mention, if you want to check out everything that Shudder has to offer, you can use the promo code Signal and get a full month for free. And now would be the perfect time to do it, because Creepshow is coming up here at the end of September. So go that way, get your free month, and then sign up for it, period, because it's a great service.
That's great. That Signal code there, that gets them an additional free month after the normal free month they get, right?
I think they get a normal free week now.
Oh,
so
okay.
It gets them an extra 3 weeks to round out the full month.
Oh,
so,
excellent.
But, yeah, certainly enough to get you through the premiere of Creepshow. So.
Sweet.
What have you been doing, Mike?
Well, I've been reading a very interesting book. I don't know exactly how I got into this whole thing, but I really started reading a lot about postmodernism and metamodernism and modernism and all the isms that go along with it. And I decided to read the book that kind of started a lot of the metamodern discussion, which is called Metamodernism, Historicity, Affect, and Depth After Postmodernism, and that's by Robin Vanden Aker. And I watched a whole bunch of stuff about him, particularly interviews with him on YouTube. Got really into it, decided to read this. I think it's going to be a very, very interesting discussion for a future horror pod class about metamodernism. I'm super, super interested in it. I also got to see It Chapter 2. So that was really good. That was really scary.
What did you think of it?
Well, because I'm reading the book about metamodernism, I had to latch on to like all of the postmodern stuff that is in that movie. And especially like Bill Hader is really, really funny in it.
Yeah. Oh, he's great.
But I don't know to what end other than to be funny. Right. So,
yeah, I mean, he's a comedian, you know, like his job, his archetype, if you will. Mm-hmm.
And I kind of thought that like the kind of meta thing about the ending of horror novels, particularly of Stephen King horror novels, was maybe little bit, you know, and I liked it because it spoke to me as a somebody that knows a lot about horror, that has read all this stuff, that has seen the original ones, that has read a lot of Stephen King, on and on. But then I looked around, and I live in South America, so I looked around and was like, I wonder how many people are getting like that, are getting that, you know? And I wonder how many people in America are like really like getting that. And I don't know. I kind of thought that was a little bit fan servicey, maybe. I don't know. But
yeah.
But all in all, I mean, super freaking scary movie. I loved it. I loved it. So.
Yeah. What did you think of the length?
I thought that the length was fine. I mean, I guess it was a little bit long. I like my movies longer though. So.
Yeah, Jack really liked it. I was not a big fan of the fact that it had 27 different endings. Like, it felt like a goddamn Lord of the Rings ending, you know? Yeah, like, I was like, I understand the need to get to the layers and the need to get to the nuance, and I'm down for that. But goddamn, at the end of it, I was just like, okay, we killed him. Can we just move on? You know, like, I'm ready for the credits to roll.
Mm-hmm.
I also think Bill Hader steals that show to such a degree that all of these other fantastic actors are like just there, you know, which I think probably just proves, because, you know, there is a pretty stellar cast here, and for Bill Hader just to walk away with it, you know, like this was 100% his movie.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was good.
It was definitely good. I do have one thing I want to ask you about, but I'm going to cut it out because I don't want to spoil anything, but I do want to ask you about this one thing.
Okay. So we'll just say, if you don't want to be spoiled for it, you know, chapter two, skip ahead about, what do you think? 2 minutes?
Yeah, probably. So Bill Hader's character, right? Was it established that he was gay in the first one?
No, okay. not in the least bit. Okay. I don't believe
it. I thought it was a little bit weird that he never really came to terms with it, other than like writing on the bridge. He still, it felt kind of unresolved to me.
Well, it not only was it unresolved, but there was a piece, I think maybe in Vanity Fair, I'll look for it and we'll stick it in the show notes, about how his portrayal as a gay character living nowadays, like, you get the distinct impression he's like been in the closet forever and ever and ever.
Oh yeah. And Pennywise says, I know your dirty little secret. Yeah. Yeah, totally.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And that's not a fair or particularly accurate representation of like being gay in 2018, 19, you know, whenever the movie takes place. And the author is an LGBT author. So, you know, it's not me making that argument, but I felt like she made some interesting analysis about how it doesn't grapple. Like, it feels much more like a movie from the 80s, right? Like, the politics of of being gay felt like the politics of the 1980s and not the politics of 2018, which I thought was really interesting. And I don't know if I fully agree with, but I think that discourse and that could be why you kind of feel like it's unresolved, because it I don't know.
I think it's
this thing that, you know, is just out there.
Yeah, I think that's right. Like if that resolution would have been given to you in the 80s, it might have been very resonant. But today, it's kind of not. It does kind of feel a little bit unresolved. Maybe a little bit like Barb's character, where she's the only one that grows up and then gets back into the same kind of, like, she's back into an abusive relationship again, right? Like, the thing that she overcame as a child, right, she then falls back into as an adult. And none of the other characters, like, do that. And so there's... And that was a criticism.
Really? I don't know. I think I disagree, right? Did you know that, I think it's Eddie is the hypochondriac, you know, the asthma guy, mm-hmm. right? I think that's right. The same actress plays his mother and his wife.
They make a
really big deal of pointing out how, like,
yeah.
he is the same person, you know? And... yeah, you know, essentially Bill Hader was a comedian and, you know, like,
okay.
The character doesn't change. He just gets this strange character tweak, you know, and by strange, I don't mean actually like that it's weird at all to be, you know, LGBT, but I mean, like, there's no allusion to it that I could find in the first one. So it feels like, it feels like an interesting twist, but definitely one that they added in the second film, you know?
And I think the other thing that makes it feel a little bit weird to me is that I kind of felt like it was almost presented in code, right? Which I didn't particularly like, because Pennywise says, "I know your dirty little secret," right? And then I start to think, I think I know what he's talking about. And then, but I'm not 100% sure until that last scene, right, where he carves it onto the thing. And then I start to think about, like, if you're like a teenager seeing this movie, if you're somebody that just kind of is casually watching this movie, I think that it would be easy to overlook it. And yeah. I don't particularly like that, because that's a main part of this character. He's obviously, you know, having some strife with this, and then comes to some resolution to it, but it's all presented in this weird code. I don't know. It was kind of weird to me.
Well, and imagine if you were, you know, like one of our students who is, you know, an LGBT youth, and it's never properly reconciled, right? And I don't think he officially comes out to anybody, does he?
No.
So then what? He just fucking carves this guy's initials on this bridge, and this is how he's dealt with the fact that he's had to repress who he's been for 40 years? That's not a wonderful... What kind of message does that send to our high school kids that may be struggling with identity? You know, like... hey, man, just swallow who you are until that guy dies because an evil clown kills him. And then you can carve your name on a bridge and everything will be fine.
Everything will be fine.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's not, I don't think that's particularly helpful. But hey, whatever. What are we? We're just two assholes with a podcast. Let's move on to the other stuff that is supposed to be our main, main topic tonight, shall we?
All right. Cool. All right. But before we get there, Dark Corners of the Web, you got something cool for us today.
Dark corners of the web.
Yeah, absolutely. So Jill Six, and I'm going to call her that because she has a super intimidating last name, but it's like Jill Garvigazion, is a local movie director who has done a series of short films that I've absolutely fallen in love with. And The Stylist is available to watch for free. She is currently raising her own money to turn what was a freaking fantastic short film into a full-length version that I think has a ton to say. I just am in love with the short film. I thought it was fantastic. And I'm super psyched to be supporting a local Kansas City film director. So we're going to put the link in the show notes. If you can give 5, 10, 15, 20 bucks, whatever, mosey on over to Kickstarter and give her some money because she's well worth it. And this film is fantastic. Don't take our words for it. Check out the short film because it's there for free. So it's like, hey, man, she believes enough in her message that she's giving away this small amount, you know, the smaller version for everybody to look at. So I think that's a super interesting and rad way to fund your films nowadays.
Totally is. So you can Google Kickstarter The Stylist. I'm sure that'll come up with it. Or there'll be a link right in the show notes.
Perfect. Sounds great. And now would be a wonderful time. If you like what we're doing here on the Horror Podcast, remember the Signal Horizon is a website, is a media organization set up by a group of teachers. We are all public school teachers. We enjoy working with students on a daily basis. We believe in the power of horror in the classroom, but we also have to pay our bills. So navigate on over to our Patreon page and give us a dollar or two. That allows, you know, perhaps, you know, a new podcast episode, or for us to see a movie, or for us to buy one of these fantastic new books that we're going to talk about that we could potentially use with our students, or at the very least, potentially use with you as you listen to the Horror Pod class.
Excellent, buddy. So what are we talking about this week?
We are talking about the, I almost said fantastic. I don't know if I would go that far, but the very good film Don't Breathe and the concept of the captive woman or the captive female.
All right. Excellent. So a lot of what we're going to talk about comes from a brand new book that just came out from Routledge Press, which is called Make America Hate Again, Trump Era Horror and the Politics of Fear, edited by Victoria McCullum. Now, we talked about this previously just as a cool book that we've been reading, but there's an article specifically about this topic in there. There'll be a link in the show notes to a Google Books kind of preview that has, I think, a couple pages, maybe like the first half of this particular article in. So you can kind of, you can read that and follow along. It is a fantastic textbook, not really textbook. This is like a college level, not really textbook, but book, right? I would describe it as, go ahead.
Yeah, I would say it's soft, right? Like some textbooks, some of the things that we reference here are really thick, and you probably have to have like a rhetoric background or at least be passively interested in postmodern philosophy to kind of get some of the references to Derrida or, you know, Foucault or, you know, whatever. This book, I think, is really much easier to get involved with and to engage with. And I was impressed with just how utterly and completely accessible that it was. So we will probably, this is not the last time that it will come up on an episode, just because I think it's a relatively easy thing to reference and an easy thing to understand.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, it reminded me of kind of some of the books that I read in college where you would have a textbook, like a hard textbook, like that goes through like everything kind of in chronological order. And then you'd have maybe two other books on the side that are either essays or case studies about particular things. So that then you could reference back, to some of the concepts that are used in these essays back into the textbook and kind of vice versa. And these were really, these are the things that I remember from, I don't remember the textbooks or any of that other stuff. I remember these books because they were like really super interesting. And I also think that the idea of that it is right now and it is about horror, that is engaging. Those two things are very engaging. So,
oh, and what I think is really badass is, not only is it a reference to modern day politics, like very specifically, each piece is written as a reflection on the politics, I would say, of the last 3 or 4 years for sure. But it also uses modern movies. There are a ton of really specific references to movies that have been made in the last 10 or 15 years. And I think there is power in looking at what pop culture is aiming its lens on, you know, is aiming its spotlight on. And, you know, horror is big right now for a lot of the reasons that we're going to talk about.
Yep. So particularly the article that got us, or the article in this book that got us very interested in this topic is by Dawn Keatley, and it's called Locker Up, Angry Men and Captive Women in Post-Recession Horror.
Yeah.
So I think that this is right up there with the other article by Scott Poole about the psychotic clown as my favorite from the book, right? This one's really smart, and she analyzes three different movies. So she references The Woman, Don't Breathe, and The Neighbor. Have you seen The Woman?
I don't think I have, no.
It is very messed up and I thought a very powerful film. Not something that I would want to go back and watch again. Kind of like Don't Breathe, frankly. I don't know if I want to go back and watch this movie again.
That's fair. I think there are parts I love about this movie, and there are parts that are tough. And I think we'll probably, when we get into the movie, we'll talk about those tough parts. But yeah, I get that. Yeah. I totally get that.
So what's Dawn Keatley's kind of main argument in this in this particular essay?
So I think she is concerned with the way post-recession horror treats female captive heroes and the archetype of the men that capture them. So she gives, I'll let you speak to The Woman if you want to, but she is really concerned with the fact that the archetype of the men that capture these women tend to be older, right? Mm-hmm. They tend to be more conservative, at least like on the cursory surface. And they also tend to be like almost overtly misogynistic, right? They come across as this, that women are at the root of the damage that is done to them and the damage done to their country. And as a result, they are justified in keeping the women in these films captive as a form of retribution, but also as a way to reclaim some of the power and identity that they think has been stolen from them that they should rightfully have.
Yes, that they've had something stolen from them or taken from them that they think that should be theirs. In some ways, like emasculated or made irrelevant. Yeah.
Yeah.
So we can definitely see that in all three of these movies. Furthermore, I think it's probably really important to talk about a concept called structure of feeling.
Okay, talk to us about structure of feeling.
So the idea, at least in this particular essay, is a reference to Raymond Williams in his book Marxism and Literature. And the structure of feeling gives us a way to discuss these things without there having to be, at least this is the way I see it. We can discuss these things and these connections without there having to be an overt directorial or writer, like not influence, but like a direct conscious effort. Okay. So, for example, these concepts that we're talking about might almost be like a cultural subconscious upwelling, right? Rather than a director or a writer or a producer sitting down and saying, like, we want to do some post-recession horror about how white men are treating women in their lives today or whatever. Right. It doesn't have to be like, sure. It doesn't have to be that
overt.
Right. And that kind of really ties in back into the current and I think quite frankly, bizarre, spontaneous rhetoric that we see that Dawn Keatley talks about explicitly, which is the chant at Trump rallies of lock her up, which is so at first I'm a little bit skeptical, right? That you've got these two kind of disparate things, right? But then you think about it and you're like, you know, that is, first off, a spontaneous like outburst, right, of some kind of emotion that in the United States is not, we are not a culture where the winner puts the loser in jail, right?
Right.
At least not till recently. We weren't. Okay.
Yeah. No, 100%.
So, right. That's something that happens in other places, not here. Right. So there's gotta be something going on, right, about that. And then if you also look, you know, Send Her Back is the latest one. Okay. And these are reserved for women only. Right.
Yeah. Almost 100%. Strong women, right? Women that have a claim to power of some kind. And I think that is part of what Keatley talks about, I think, in such a powerful turn, that it's not a meek woman. It's not a woman that has traditionally been easily bullied to, quote unquote, be put into her place. But these are women that are claiming power, that are seen kind of at the pinnacle of where they are at. And the outcropping of our horror to show more and more women that are not just killed, that are not abused, but are actually chained up, that are actually locked up, I think is a really powerful place that we find ourselves, because it reflects the politics of where we are at, you know? And almost 100% of the time, if you look at these particular horror movies, and there are a ton of them that have been produced in the last, I would say, 5 years, that one of the central conceits is a woman has been locked in a cell or locked in a box. Or the way more interesting thing is the dude that does that locking and how closely it may align itself with an actual MAGA rally, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think there is no doubt the intersectionality of that. If whether or not it was purposeful, I think is a finer debate to be had, but I think, I think it bears discussion.
I don't. So, but that's the thing, is that I don't think that it's a debate that necessarily has to be had, right? It doesn't have to be conscious.
Oh, I agree.
You know, in many ways, if it is or if it isn't, if it is in some movies and it isn't, I mean, that's interesting. That's worthwhile, but it's not necessary for it to be.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And I think that's one of the really interesting things that our friend Orrin Gray has always maintained, right? When we disagree on a movie or when we agree about film criticism or whatever, he can say a movie can be racist, right? A movie can be homophobic without making the argument the director is homophobic himself, right? Without making the argument that the actors that participated in this thing are inherently of the politics of the movie, that sometimes the politics of the movie, like, happen completely, entirely on their own. And as a result, it is 100% fine to, you know, to partake in some sort of literary criticism or whatever of the novel or of the movie, without implying that the people that participated in making this art are also awful people. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's a really important distinction, I think.
All right, so we haven't talked exactly about probably the most critical part about this, which is the men that take the captives, right? What kind of things do they all have in common?
Well, at least if we're looking, again, you'll have to speak to the first movie. But if you're looking at the others, they are Caucasian. They are older. They have a military background. You know,
at least a strong thing, or a strong desire. The interesting thing about in the movie, the woman, the guy has a relatively like, kind of like white collar like job, I think if I remember correctly. Okay. He's got a really white collar job, but he hunts, and that's his like way to get his like masculinity back or something. He hunts, and that's when he finds the feral woman from that he takes as a captive. He is much less of a, he is much more of a just straight up villain than the blind man in Don't Breathe. Because I think the blind man is a very, is very interesting because he is a, there is a point where you think that he might be.
Hold on. Don't give up any spoilers till we get to that section. That way we can.
Okay. Okay.
Warn our people.
All right. Well, maybe I already did. Darn it. Anyways. yeah. Okay. Well, we'll get to that later, but I think that he's definitely portrayed in a different light while still being the villain. Okay. But he's definitely portrayed in a much different way. But all of these guys have had something that's almost like in The Woman, he blames the women in his life for basically everything that goes wrong. There's this like feeling of like loss from these guys, and they're not, sure. And they're not typical, typical horror movie villains that have superpowers or can get into your dreams or have like razor blades on their fingers or anything like that, right? These are just normal guys, really.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of what's kind of spooky about it. Except in Split.
Yeah.
I guess in Split he does have some superpowers, but we don't see those until later, I guess.
But I think what is important is they have this aggrieved sense of mentality, right? Like they have been wronged and they can justify their actions because of this specific transgression that they believe that women have committed against themselves, right? Like there's this great quote that she includes from one of those movies from the main guy that has done the imprisoning,
mm-hmm.
where he says, "I'm so fucking sick of you can't from the women in this family making that all women because you're leeches, every one of you. You suck a man dry. He works like a dog every day, and then you suck him dry." You know, like I have heard this from some, you know, folks in my extended family that grow up in this kind of old, not always rural, but typically rural, you know, since that. Women are this necessary evil, and at the end of the day, all they do is spend your money and make things difficult on you.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's a very small step from that line of thinking to, you know, imprisoning them or, you know, killing them or whatever. And I think Don Keatley very smartly points that out.
Well, and there's definitely different levels of kind of the imprisonment that we could definitely talk about. I mean, an abusive relationship, it can be mentally abusive in a way where it is difficult to leave. There's a great podcast. I mean, I listen to it as a podcast. I think a lot of people also listen to it on their local NPR affiliate. It's called On the Media. And we'll put a link in the show notes to one of their very recent episodes called Very Bitter Joke. And it's they've got a couple of different segments. One of them is about the reauthorization of the Violence Against Women Act, which is currently up for reauthorization, and it looks like it's going to get blocked because of some NRA stuff. So it's very, very interesting, and they have a great interview with I'm not sure exactly who it's with, but they have a great interview on there, and they talk about exactly that, about how one of the things that stuck out to me most is that they talk about how, you know, a lot of people say, this person gets murdered by her husband, or, oh, she was in this abusive relationship, why didn't she just leave? And she talks about how that's the most dangerous part, is when you leave, and that there's this long term, there's usually a lot of like long term planning before they, hiding money, you know, getting all the ducks in the row, maybe getting an education. She talks about one specific story where of a woman that she worked with who went through years of this planning in order to get out. I guess what I'm getting at is that the imprisonment doesn't necessarily have to be the physical imprisonment that we're seeing in these. I mean, it can be a mental, it can just be the threat of physical violence and like that kind of stuff. So.
Oh yeah. No, I think you're absolutely right. And the NRA stuff that you talked about, like, is really fascinating because the NRA has moved very strongly to prevent laws that if you are charged with, or if they, you know, if you have a domestic violence case pending, right, then they can confiscate your guns. And that is a big deal. And that is part of that act and that reauthorization. And the NRA fought against it initially and continues to fight against it. And maybe now would be a good time to transition into a good discussion of that movie, because a gun plays a pretty significant role in this movie.
Man, that is a really stellar transition there, man. Thank you.
Fuck yeah, I've been working on it.
That's good. That's good. Two more articles, though. You've got one from The New Yorker about Don't Breathe that we'll link to. You've got one from, of course, The Guardian, because you've always got to have one from The Guardian in there. All right.
Hey, what can I say? I love Manchester. It's a great place. All right. One from The Guardian is just a straight up review, but it's I think it's got some interesting things to say. So yeah, we'll link to those if you want some further reading about the kind of philosophy behind Don't Breathe.
All right, so part two, we're going to talk about the movie. I'm going to ring the spoiler bell, but if you haven't seen this movie, man, it's pretty powerful. It's pretty powerful.
Yeah,
I would definitely recommend it. It's got, well, spoiler bell. All right, hoping to walk away with a massive fortune, a trio of thieves break into a house of a blind man who isn't as helpless as he seems. This movie, I think, has got about the most powerful mid-course turn I've ever seen.
Yeah. Oh, you're going to get to that scene first?
I'm just throwing it out there. I think it's,
you're going to go to the turkey baster scene first.
No, that's not when they find the captive woman in the basement. Like, that's the,
yeah. But she's captive because she's been impregnated by the turkey baster.
Exactly. I mean, it is. Yeah. So. And I think if you, because I saw some of the early trailers, you don't know that this is going to be a movie about that, right? You think it's going to be way more about something else. So anyways.
Yeah. I mean, it sets itself up to be a straightforward, like, home invasion story, kind of. And in that way, kind of early on, it reminds me vaguely of this couple of movies called The Collector and The Collection.
Mm-hmm.
That it's like a reversal almost of a typical home invasion film. And that is totally the movie that you think you're getting. And then they get to the basement and you're like, this is a wholly fucking different movie than I thought originally. And this is way darker than that, you know?
And it is a absolutely fantastic inversion of the revenge movie, right? I mean this is like the revenge movie gone wrong. And this is the aftermath.
I think that's super interesting, because this truly is like, I don't know. I think that's a great observation, Mike, because it is almost the exact opposite of a rape revenge film, right? Where you have this, you know, this terrible thing that's done to this woman, right? And often it's done with this super male gazy grossness, right? And then this woman enacts her revenge and, you know, things are gruesome and violent, yada, yada, yada. But like, theoretically, if you buy the blind man's side of the story, then he is the aggrieved one, and he sees this rape that takes place as, you know, his retribution, right? And which is fucking terrifying and gross and awful. But yeah, I think that's some interesting to hold up, say, you know, Revenge, right? Which came out last year. I think you can still see it on Shudder. Against this movie, I think would be an interesting double feature, because they are very similar, but also 100% not. And that's totally fucked. And I think probably goes to what Don Keatley is talking about.
Yes, definitely. And one of the things that she also points out, which I think is really fascinating, is that the blind man's goal here is not necessarily just revenge. It is to ensure his own future.
Oh, yeah.
And that is messed up, because it goes exactly into line with, you know, the kind of the aggrieved white post-industrial male who sees himself as not having a future anymore.
Well, and not having a future and not being relevant, right? Like, that's the thing that I think that demographic is really struggling with. It's, you know, probably in an existential way, it's about, like, you know, some weird form of white supremacy. But at the end of the day, like, this guy is no longer relevant to the conversation. He's no longer a demographic that marketers are going after. His opinion only matters in the context of, like, the fact that he has literally trapped people in his house, mm-hmm. you know? So that is a fascinating conversation, that all of this is done essentially just so fucking people will listen to this guy again, you know? So he can mansplain what is going on.
Yeah.
And he does some pretty significant mansplaining at the end of this movie, yeah?
Yes, yes. So, I mean, essentially what we've got is we got Rocky, Alex, and Money, right? Three kids living in 20-something-year-old kids living in post-industrial Detroit. They break into the blind man's house because he's got a bunch of money, and then they find out the blind man's got a girl tied up in the basement. And
that's it.
And then we get to hear the story about how the blind man got the money. We kind of already know that. His daughter was killed by a rich girl, and she got off scot-free, didn't go to jail because rich girls don't go to jail. Would it have been any different if she would have gone to jail? How would it have been different if she would have gone to jail, though, for the blind guy? You know, like, would that, you know, I mean, it's almost like that's maybe just a reason. That's just a reason. Like, oh, she didn't go to jail, so I got to get some revenge another way. And then he wants a kid, you know, because his kid was taken, so he wants another one. I'll tell you a story. I'll spin you out a script where the blind man's the hero. All right. So his daughter gets killed. The rich girl doesn't go to jail. Then he's blind, right? So he's got to go on and get some revenge. Her parents, because in one of these revenge movies, like, the person who is getting revenge has to inflict that revenge upon people that are necessarily totally evil, right? Or
right.
Okay, so the rich girl's
unredeemable. Yeah.
The rich girl's parents are involved in all kinds of shady crap, all kinds of shady, like, garbage, and they're into stuff with the mafia, because when the blind man shows up, he's got to kill a bunch of people, right? Because we got to have some action. So there's got to be some goons to kill, right? And then he gets his revenge. And then, you know what? Rich girl, she's got a daughter, and that's the only one that's left from this garbage family. And he saves that daughter and then raises her as his own. It would be like the Book of Eli and Payback together.
Right? Okay. I've got a better version. All right.
Okay.
I've got a better version that I think will appeal to the MAGA crowd and this, you know, growing movie market of Christian folks. Okay.
Okay.
Same movie through the whole thing. Only we find the woman that is captive in the basement, and maybe this will be controversial. You can always cut it out if you think it's too controversial. We come to find out he kidnapped her. She was already pregnant, so there's none of that turkey baster shit. That's all fucked up. But he kidnapped her on her way to the abortion clinic.
Oh, that would be.
And so he is only keeping her captive in the basement so that he can bring this child that, you know, maybe wasn't going to be brought back into this world. And that will be how he evens the scale.
I think that
tell me that shit Ben Shapiro would jump for in a heartbeat, and you know it.
So I think it's, yeah, I mean, it's interesting that whenever I think of the blind man, I think, and he never gets a name, right?
Right.
He's purposefully, all, purposefully, yeah. Right? He never gets a name because he doesn't even warrant, that's how irrelevant he is. He doesn't even warrant one. He is portrayed almost as the character that I think of probably is Michael Douglas in Falling Down. I think if we want to trace this archetype back, we can trace it back to that character, because that character is in many ways similar. He's irrelevant. He's lost his family, right? And then he engages in violence.
Yeah. Well, he's been good to the point where he can't be good anymore. He's done being good. He's done playing the game. And in that way, there is, and oh my gosh, I think I win tonight. All right. I think I win tonight.
All right.
In that way, this movie feels a little Ligotian in that there is this just like overwhelming like death march of darkness that's like bleakness that surrounds this film, you know? Because like, yeah, like undoubtedly this guy did this really bad shit, you know? But he has played this game for so long that his sad story, like, it doesn't justify any of his work, but yeah, like, undoubtedly, he's had a pretty shitty life, you know? Like, he played the game, he did everything he was supposed to, and he still ended up in this really terrible position, so all he's doing is reenacting the pain that he's essentially had in his life on everybody else. Tell me that doesn't at least speak a little bit to some Thomas Ligotti stuff.
Well, I mean, it's totally bleaking in Detroit. I mean, that's...
Right? Yeah. Right? Yeah.
So... I mean,
but
I mean,
there are babies involved, so the antinatalist shit would, you know, kind of wipe
that's right. That's right. Now, look, here's an interesting thing. You said that he played by the rules the whole time and he was like a good guy up until this thing. We don't know that. Why would you assume that?
I don't know, right? Like, isn't he blind because he I guess I assume
they say he's a war vet. I mean, that right. doesn't
I assumed his blindness came from being in the war, and as a result he's, you know, one of these cogs that the war machine is, you know,
it might be, I mean, I think
essentially discarded. I don't know.
I mean, I think that we give him probably a little bit more credit than he's due. I don't think that we ever learn what happened to his wife, right? Did she die in the same accident? I'm not 100% sure.
I thought she did.
Maybe. But, I mean, he's the last man standing on his block. I mean,
and that's why this film, right? And this is kind of Mike and I's pet project, but post-recession horror, I think, is super fascinating because you get these big, long shots of the neighborhood with all of these houses that are kind of falling apart or that have been abandoned or that they're trying to sell or that are in foreclosure that were once decent houses that are no longer. And that, like, abandoned neighborhood kind of shot is really indicative of that post-recession horror that we have talked so much about. And you're right. He's a little bit like the Omega Man, you know? Like, he's it.
It just... I think the ending of this movie is so brilliant. And we already rang the spoiler bell, so I hope everybody's already seen this ending, because I think it is great where... Everybody assumes, just like you did, that he's a great guy. And we get this, like, shot at the end of him on TV as this blind war hero who killed two home invaders. I mean, that is, like, the kind of stuff that would totally go up on... That would be the headline on Fox News for a week, man.
Yeah, yeah. The only thing that killed these three bad guys with a gun... was
a good this guy one, with a gun.
Right, this one war vet with a gun.
It's really amazing when you look at that particular type of subculture. That I mean, these are all people that follow the law every day, right? But how quickly we are to, if the law doesn't work, it's okay to go the next step. Okay, you will find in conservative media a real champion of, you know, somebody kills a home invader, right?
Oh yeah.
And then you'll also find, not necessarily on the media outlets, but you'll find kind of in the meme culture that surrounds it, things like there'll be fake articles about like a father that murdered a pedophile or something like that, and then you find out, and then you go to Snopes and you find out that stuff didn't really happen, and like kind of stuff. This extrajudicial stuff you'll find a lot,
and
I think it's super, super important here that we see this extrajudicial act as, in here, we see it for what it really is, right? Now, because it's the logical, like, extension of a fucked up extrajudicial act, right? I mean, it's like we get to see the aftermath, and that's what I'm getting at. That's what I think really makes it powerful, is that we don't see it like happen. We get to see the aftermath, because even if he would have just gone and killed her, right? The aftermath of that would be horrific. You know, you murdered somebody over this to get back nothing. You know.
Yeah, that's good. You want to know somebody who does not share our passion for this film?
Oh, anonymous Amazon user. What does he have?
Oh, yeah.
He's probably got something to say about, probably about the gun in particular or something.
No. Okay. I looked. All right. I tried to find one, but I could not.
Okay. Anonymous Amazon user says, are we supposed to have sympathy for people who break into a blind man's house to rob him? Any violence he does to them in self-defense is completely within his rights. He's obviously barely keeping it together, but it's okay to rob another person as long as you can benefit from it. And then there's some disturbing sexual violence against the two women that's supposed to make us redeem these terrible characters. The premise is idiotic and teaches terrible values. Is anyone dumb enough to feel for these characters as Stephen Lang chases them? Can anyone possibly think Jane Levy is justified in taking his money and getting people killed so that she can buy two train tickets? Didn't she already have enough money from her first poorly justified robbery? At least that was from rich people and not a disabled poor person. To get out of town with all this violence, terrible. I think that's the point. I guess we're supposed to kind of like a little bit these characters, but they're not like, you know.
Yeah,
he's looking for a hero, right? And here, you're probably not going to find it. So
no, and what I find most disturbing about this review, and if you go look at all of the 1-star reviews, and there are quite a few of them here, they gloss over essentially the second half of this film. They're really focused on the fact that these people are trying to steal money from, you know, what they see as a disabled
war vet, who gave his sight
for this country. Yeah,
freedom isn't free, Tyler.
Oh, fuck.
He paid a hefty, hefty fee.
We're gonna get a lot of shitty emails about this, and you're gonna have to respond to all of them because you're the actual war vet. So, yeah, I'll just forward them on to you.
Okay, we'll do.
But I think they miss the grander turn of this movie, which is like none of that is justification for treating women like your Thanksgiving turkey. You know, like it's not property to own. They are full-fledged individuals that don't make your life difficult, that don't play a role just to, I don't know, to either produce a child or to steal your shit, that they are autonomous individuals that older men, you know, in their 50s and 60s, no longer have the power to control. But, you know, maybe I'm simplifying the message down because I focus so much on the second half.
I don't know. And what the fuck is this blind man going to do with a kid? That's as horrific, right? He's going to raise this. Oh my gosh. It's like that movie, The Room. Do you remember The Room? That was a tough
read watch, that book. That was fucked.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. That was a tough read. You know, and I think to extrapolate this maybe out.
Holy shit. Maybe this is the prequel to The Room.
Oh gosh. To extrapolate it out a little bit further, right? I mean, you know, you look at Stephen Lang and I'm sorry, you look at the blind man and you're like, you know, you can see his sins are like readily apparent. And what got him there, right, is essentially, I guess that his character flaw, other than being a complete psychopath, right, is another thing that he's got is he has the inability to change. Right? I mean, there's blind people all over the country that have productive, engaged lives, right? And that's possible, right? But I would be willing to guess that even before his daughter was killed, that he was probably not adapting well to life in general.
Oh yeah, and I'm sure was rigid in his, I don't know, social constructs. I'm like, come on. There's no way the blind man was like super progressive before all of this happened. You know, he was not like, maybe this socialized medicine is not that bad. No. We should give that Pete Buttigieg a chance. Yeah, you know? He's not fucking doing that.
Yeah. I like that Yang guy.
Yeah, right. Yeah. He's probably saying, like, my Detroit neighborhood has really changed since when I bought this house and blah, 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 blah. Which I think is probably, to bring things full circle, Don Keatley's point that he is an echo of the very type of person that you would catch at a MAGA rally, you know? And as a result, there is some connection to be made there. Now, are we saying that everybody at a MAGA rally is going to kidnap and rape a woman with a turkey baster? Certainly not. But there has been an uptick in the rhetoric about locking powerful women up. The most powerful woman in this film was certainly locked up by somebody that, you know, bears a lot of similarities to the former. So I don't know. I think it makes it really interesting.
Well, and if you would ask me, what, 5 years ago, if something as outrageous as chance to lock up someone who loses a political contest was something that was going to happen, I would say, you know, it doesn't happen here, right? And I think that's what everybody
said. Not our country.
It doesn't happen here, and you know, and quite frankly, it doesn't, you know. Things like what the blind guy did, right? I mean, that doesn't happen when people are going after revenge. Yeah, it does. It does here, right?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. No shit.
All right,
man. I think we have effectively freed the captive woman. Hopefully.
I don't think so. I think this is something that we're gonna
revisit.
I think this is a trend that's probably going to continue. I mean, she references like 10 different films, and I was like, oh my gosh, this is a thing.
It's a thing, and as long as our politics don't change rapidly or whatever, then yeah, I would imagine it will keep popping up.
Yep.
So very good, Mikey. Well, where can they catch more of your shit out on the internet?
On the interwebs, at signalhorizon.com. And I've got some stuff on Goodreads. You can follow me on Goodreads. Link in the show notes.
Excellent. You can follow more of my stuff at Ty Unsell, at T-Y-U-N-S-E-L-L, or you can check out Signal Horizon on Facebook, or really where we want you at. We would love for you to engage in some more discourse around the captive woman would be on the Horror Podcast Facebook group. That's where we have our conversations, we talk about past episodes, and you can tell us what you would like us to cover on the next episode. We would be glad to try to get whatever kind of folks that you want us to go out into the horror community and grab. We'll get actors or directors or writers. We are happy to do your bidding.
We'll
so
get the,
check us out.
We'll get the grip. That's the guy that, yeah. That's the guy who holds the microphone. We'll get the guy
that
sits behind a camera.
We'll get crafts services, you know, food services to talk about what they were serving on set. We'll do whatever you tell us to do.
I want
to
know. We're here for you.
Very good. Well, next week we are going to cover, along with one of our writers from Signal Horizon, a movie that I'm going to admit to something right now, Mike.
Yeah. Okay?
I've never seen Blue Velvet.
You have seen Blue Velvet. You watched it with me in college. No, man. I think I might have made you watch it in college when I was obsessed with David Lynch.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And you were as obsessed with David Lynch as you were Thomas Ligotti. So, but I think I was pretty drunk that night, so I don't remember much of it. But I have done a little bit of preliminary reading, and there is a lot of analysis about Blue Velvet and The Wizard of Oz.
Really?
Yep. So next week we're going to talk about Blue Velvet and The Wizard of Oz.
Heck yeah! That should be. Man, I think that's going to be a lot more uplifting than this episode.
For sure.
For sure. Okay, until next week.
Class dismissed.